Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again and welcome. I'm Jim Tedder in Washington with the program that tells you interesting things about our world and helps you improve your American English skills at the same time. Today we have something serious and deadly to talk about, and then some fun. First, some things left over from wars are still killing people. Yes, landmines are still a big problem for much of the world. Then, we thought they were gone forever, but vinyl records are making a big comeback in South Africa. It's a fun story that is about 5 minutes away on As It Is. Let's get ready to listen and learn. The International Campaign to Ban Landmines says there are 9 new landmine victims around the world every day. A group of young people from the United States recently went overseas to investigate the problem. Bob Doty reports on their experiences in some of the most affected areas.
Melanie Saltzman is a student at Northwestern University's Medill Graduate School of Journalism in Evanston, Illinois. She recently traveled halfway around the world to Cambodia. She met there with members of a rural community who have suffered horrible injuries from landmine accidents. Cambodia has one of the largest populations of amputees, individuals who have had an arm or leg removed.
So I knew that I wanted to go there and meet people on the ground and see how survivors were affected.
Melanie Saltzman met a 17-year-old girl who had lost a leg a month earlier. She says the girl was frightened.
I wanted to tell this story because I wanted to see what survivors go through on a daily basis, long after landmines are gone or long after accidents have happened.
Ms. Saltzman was part of a team of students from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism. They studied the effects of landmines and cluster bombs around the world, and what steps the United States is taking to disarm them. The U.S. government is spending $3.2 billion on the cleanup effort. Josh Meyer led the student journalism project.
Each year we pick a topic that we think is a real substantive topic for the students to tackle, something that's going to give us a good story one way or the other that will allow them to travel internationally. And this year we picked landmines and cluster munitions.
In addition to Cambodia, students also reported from Jordan, Mozambique, Ukraine, and a still-active battle area, Iraq. Matthew Schell studied mine clearance operations in Iraqi Kurdistan.
It's exhilarating. We've invested so much time researching this topic, and to be out there in the field face-to-face with the people who are actually doing this work was magnificent. I'm a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, and I have a personal investment in the country. And so the subject matter is something which speaks very directly to me.
Matthew Schell carried out his investigation for the Medill Graduate School of Journalism's National Security Reporting Project. The project deals with issues related to defense, security, and civil liberties. Josh Meyer was happy with all the work this year.
Getting them out there traveling to places like this, I think, is just a really cool experience for the students. And they really do learn things that you just can't learn in the classroom.
The United States is a world leader in landmine cleanup work. But the students found a lot more still needs to be done to disarm and remove these weapons. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Next, we take a trip back in time. First, there were wax cylinders, then 78 RPMs, then 45s and albums. Next came CDs. Now, much of the music we hear each day is digital and is not even stored in physical form. But as Marcia James tells us, many people in South Africa are turning back the clock to a time when vinyl records were the only thing.
Benji Moody owns Vinyl Junkie. He flips through records inside his Johannesburg store. His vinyl albums are much more expensive than CDs or MP3s, digital audio records. Prices range from a few dollars to about $35 for a copy of a classic rock album in perfect condition. Yet Mr. Moody, a music expert and record label boss, says his sales have increased greatly in the past year. He says young South Africans are driving the vinyl explosion.
It's become hip to have records again. A lot of young people are the bulk of the people that buy vinyl now, people under 30 that were only being born when vinyl went into decline in the mid-80s.
Benji Moody says young people are discovering music their parents and even grandparents grew up with, and they want to listen to it just like their older relatives did on vinyl.
They're buying the classics. They're buying Zeppelin and the Doors and Hendrix and the Beatles and the Stones.
Benji Moody believes increased demand for vinyl is linked to young South Africans realizing that the age of pop idols manufactured by TV isn't so great after all.
Young people are looking for something different. They're tired of being force-fed by radio, contemporary radio, and by record companies, force-fed a diet of people that all sound the same.
But the main reason for the vinyl rise, he says, is that music simply sounds better and feels better on vinyl.
Vinyl to me sounds warmer and it has depth, it's got echo, it's got soul. Whereas digital is very clear, very precise, very Teutonic, but it's soulless. Vinyl is visceral, it's a visceral experience. You take it, you pick it up, it's something to look at. You can't look at an MP3.
A few years ago, Kevin Stewart started selling his vinyl collection from home to earn money. Seeing a big demand for his records, he opened the Record Mad Shop in northern Johannesburg. Inside his store, the needle on a record player begins a recording.
I get a lot of young people coming in here and saying, my dad just gave me his record player, a bunch of records and a record player, so I'm, you know, expanding on that. So I think it was definitely driven by media and by reviewers, and, you know, I think people just got really, really sick and tired of MP3s.
Do you like Modest Mouse?
I used to.
Because we've got the new one in of that.
An assistant helps a customer at Mr. Stewart's store.
I think a lot of people can still relate to records. You know, my dad had this, my mom had this. I grew up listening to Noddy on vinyl or Led Zeppelin or AC/DC or whatever it was.
Kevin Stewart says the rebirth of vinyl is resulting in a rebirth of music in South Africa.
People are connecting with music again in a way that, you know, our parents used to, our hippie fathers and our, you know, whatever, acid head mothers, you know.
Stewart does expect the hype or intense excitement about vinyl to decrease, but he adds that a real love of vinyl records has been brought to life again, and South Africans are all the better for it. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm Jim Tedder in Washington. You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. The largest chicken meat producer in the United States says it will stop giving its birds antibiotics that doctors use to treat humans. Tyson Foods made the announcement April 28th. It said it plans to complete the change by 2017. Health experts say overuse of the medicines is part of the reason more bacteria are becoming resistant to them. Farmers have fed livestock small amounts of antibiotics for many years. The drugs help the animals grow faster and prevent the spread of sickness among farm animals that live close together. But bacteria living in and on the animals develop and become immune to the drugs. In other words, the antibiotics no longer have any effect. These drug-resistant bacteria then enter the bodies of people who eat the birds or livestock. Then infections in humans become more costly and difficult to treat. Sometimes treatment does not work at all. Donnie Smith is the president of Tyson Foods. He says the company has already begun reducing its use of antibiotics.
As a result of our efforts, only a very small percentage of our chicken flocks receive human antibiotics today.
He says the company will stop giving its birds antibiotics by the end of 2017. Sasha Stashwick is a policy expert at the Natural Resources Defense Council environmental group. The NRDC has been calling for an end to the use of antibiotics in animals for many years. Ms. Stashwick says other companies have recently announced their decision to end the use of the medicine in the animals they produce.
We're seeing that, you know, over a third of the industry at this point either has eliminated the use of medically important antibiotics in its production or has made a public commitment to do so within the next few years.
While the use of antibiotics in birds and livestock is decreasing in the U.S. and Europe, it is expected to increase in the developing world. There is a growing demand for meat there. Livestock producers in those countries are using methods that require antibiotics to keep animals healthy. Ramanan Lakshminarayan is the director of the Center for Disease Dynamics, Economics, and Policy. He says Tyson's announcement shows food producers can continue to operate without using the drugs. Mr. Lakshminarayan says if producers provide cleaner living conditions and better nutrition for their animals, they will not need to give them antibiotics. But he says the buying public must pressure farmers to stop using the drugs. And that's the VOA Learning English Environment and Science Report. For more agriculture, environment, and science stories, go to our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. I'm Marcia James.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. Growing tensions in Europe and Asia created a serious conflict for Americans during the 1930s. Most Americans opposed the fascist or military leaders gaining control in Germany, Italy, Japan, and other countries. But they were not willing to take any firm action to stop this growing movement. Americans did not want to become involved in another world war, and they called on President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and their representatives in Congress to remain neutral in world affairs. But aggression by Germany and Japan finally would force Americans to choose between their love of democracy and their desire for peace. The first challenge to America's policy of neutrality came in October 1935. Troops from fascist Italy invaded Ethiopia. Roosevelt did not feel neutral at all. He told his advisors, "Italy is dropping bombs on Ethiopia, and that is war." He sharply criticized the fascist Italian leader Benito Mussolini. Roosevelt issued an order banning Americans from sending arms to either Italy or Ethiopia, and he called on Americans not to send oil or other materials to Italy. Roosevelt's efforts to stop the export of oil and other products did not succeed, but the efforts by the White House played an important part in leading the League of Nations to take economic actions against Italy. Less than 2 years later, civil war broke out in Spain. Spanish fascists led by General Francisco Franco tried to overthrow the democratic government in Madrid. Some Americans went to join the Democratic Army in Spain to fight Franco. But Roosevelt and the Congress agreed that America should remain officially neutral in the conflict. In this way, Roosevelt was meeting the wishes of the American people by avoiding war. But personally, he was deeply troubled by the events in Europe. In a letter to his ambassador in France, Roosevelt wrote, "One cannot help feeling that the whole European situation is blacker than at any time in your lifetime or mine." Another challenge to American neutrality came in Asia. Japan launched a new invasion of China in July 1937. Within 1 month, Japanese forces gained control of what was then called Peking, now Beijing, and Tianjin. The United States had long supported the nationalist forces of China, and many Americans were angry about the Japanese invasion. But Roosevelt and his administration once again refused to take strong actions against the aggression. For one thing, the American Navy was weak. There was little it could do to stop Japanese aggression thousands of miles away in Asia. And neither Roosevelt nor the Congress wanted to be the first to break America's official policy of neutrality. Franklin Roosevelt made clear in private talks with friends that he understood the serious threat to world peace created by Adolf Hitler and other fascists. He believed that the United States could not remain neutral forever if democracy was threatened in so many countries. However, Roosevelt did little to educate the nation about this threat. Instead, he generally followed the wishes of the majority of people who wanted America to remain neutral. Public opinion in the United States was strongly against any kind of involvement in foreign conflicts. In 1937, Roosevelt made an important speech calling for the world's neutral nations to protect themselves from lawless,
fascist nations. But many Americans feared that Roosevelt was trying to create a new alliance, and they opposed his efforts. A public opinion survey at the time showed that less than 1 in 3 Americans was willing to change the nation's strong neutrality laws to give Roosevelt more freedom of action. In the same year, Japanese planes sank an American gunboat in the Yangtze River in China. But few Americans showed any interest in going to war over the incident. Instead, they accepted Japanese apologies. Americans simply had no desire to fight. Most Americans honestly believed that the best hope for their country was neutrality. One of the most influential supporters of neutrality was Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota. He told the New York Times in 1937 that there can be no objection to any action the government may take which tries to bring peace to the world. But that action, he added, must not tie the American people into another world death march. He said, "I very much fear that we are once again being caused to feel that the call is upon America to police a world that chooses to follow insane leaders." Adolf Hitler's Nazi forces moved into the Rhineland in 1936. 2 years later, they invaded Austria. And then, in the following months, Hitler began making demands on the government of Czechoslovakia. Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain was afraid that Hitler might start a general European war if he was blocked from gaining control of Czechoslovakia. In September of 1938, Chamberlain traveled to Munich to discuss the situation with the German leader. The result was that Britain agreed to a German takeover of Czechoslovakia. Chamberlain returned to London, promising peace in our time.
The settlement of the Czechoslovakian problem, which has now been achieved, is, in my view, only the prelude to a larger settlement in which all Europe may find peace. This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine. Some of you perhaps have already heard what it contains, but I would just like to read it to you. We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again.
The first reaction of most Americans to Chamberlain's Munich agreement was one of relief. But then public opinion changed. Americans saw that Hitler's Germany now had control of Central Europe. Japan was becoming more powerful in Asia. Chamberlain's weakness only served to show dictators that they could gain land and power through aggression and fear. Roosevelt warned Americans in late 1938 about this fascist threat. "There can be no peace," he said, "if another nation makes the threat of war its national policy."
There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the threat of war. There can be no peace if national policy adopts as a deliberate instrument the dispersion all over the world of millions of helpless and persecuted wanderers with no place to lay their heads. There can be no peace if humble men and women are not free to think their own thoughts, to express their own feelings, and to worship God. There can be no peace if economic resources that ought to be devoted to social and economic reconstruction are to be diverted to an intensified competition in armaments.
Roosevelt and much of the American public continued to hope that the United States could stay out of foreign conflicts. But increasingly they understood that war might come, and they began to prepare for possible hostilities. Following the Munich Agreement, Roosevelt requested a large increase in the defense budget. He asked Britain and France to buy arms from American manufacturers to give those companies more experience in producing weapons. And he helped bring about an agreement among nations in North and South America to join together to oppose fascist threats to peace and security. Finally, Roosevelt tried to get Congress to change the neutrality laws. He wanted more freedom as president to resist fascist aggression and help Britain, France, China, and other friendly nations. Congress, however, continued to resist such changes. But events in early 1939 showed that war was on the way. Germany occupied Czechoslovakia and then Lithuania. Franco's forces took control in Spain. Italy invaded Albania. And then Hitler began making demands on Poland. In August, Germany and the Soviet Union announced to the world that they had signed a joint defense agreement. A week later, Germany attacked Poland. Two days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. Germany's invasion of Poland and the beginning of the war presented a giant challenge to the United States. On the one hand, almost all Americans supported the European democracies opposing the aggression by Hitler, Mussolini, and other fascists. But on the other hand, Americans had no desire to fight in what might be a long and bloody war. The following months would force Americans of all political beliefs to consider this problem. It would be a final period of peace for the United States before events once again drew it into a terrible world conflict. Our program was written by David Jarmel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.